Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, if you would take your seats, your assigned seats if possible, so we won't have as much trouble identifying you up here. And before we start the meeting, we have a very, very special guest among us. We think a celebrity in our midst is the former governor of Utah, Mike Leavitt, in the audience at this moment. Would you, all right, Governor, we are ready to, just for people to see you. You don't have to come forward right now at this very moment. But ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome the former governor of Utah and the former secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome to the Health Committee, Governor, and especially to Arkansas. All right, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I need a motion. Your minutes are on your desk, and I need...
We don't have minutes.
We
don't have minutes today.
All right. I stand corrected. We don't have minutes today. All right. Out of respect for the governor, we are going to put his item at the very beginning, and if you wouldn't mind coming forward... we're going to be have a discussion of the development of the amendment to the Arkansas 1115 waiver, and we'd ask you that you come to the table and identify yourselves.
My name is David Ferguson. I'm the Governmental Relations Director for a nonprofit corporation known as Conduit for Action. Most of my career was spent here in these buildings. I was with the Bureau of Legislative Research for 32 years, drafting legislation and analyzing statutes. And I spent the last 6 years of that career as the Director of the Bureau of Legislative Research, and I have been back in my home place of Ash Flat for the last year and a half. What I want to address, that there has been some questions about what happens if Arkansas was to defund the private option, and would there be any penalties for it? And I began my investigation looking at that question and realized that there are some terms and conditions from CMS that in my opinion, could impose some of those penalties, and of course, Mr. Miller, who's on your staff, can address those better. But in looking at it, what I have discovered is that your act that you passed last time, the Health Care Independence Act of 2013, there was a lot of safeguards and walls built into that legislation, and I know they were hard fought. On both sides, or all three sides, or four sides. But what I have discovered, we went through the process where DHS was authorized by the Act to file for a waiver within the confines of the law. They have to do that. But then the surprise, I think, to many is that once the waiver was approved, CMS, which is Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, imposed about 30 pages of conditions. And a lot of those seemed like reasonable type things to do if you're in an agency. The problem is that many of those conditions appear to conflict directly with the safeguards that you put into your legislation. So we're operating under CMS terms and conditions that probably shouldn't have been approved. And again, I'm not saying whether it was a good idea or not a good idea. It's just that the legislation that you passed doesn't seem to provide for that. And let me give you one of the examples. I know that everybody talked about the triggers. One of those triggers that people talked about is that if federal funding for some reason was just to fall down below a certain level, that we terminate. In fact, your law says it will automatically terminate within 120 days, not more than 120 days, but within 120 days. That is not what your terms and conditions say. Your terms and conditions now tell you that you've got to go through a 7-month notice period and a bunch of other steps, get approval, and maybe we're going to let you off. So your law's trigger is, it was not, I don't think that the federal government looked at those, at the legislation and said, can we write these conditions in a way that it'll meet the Arkansas law? They just did what they thought they ought to be doing. One of those things that was pretty clearly built into the legislation was a very good flexibility to get out. I mean, people were afraid that we might get into this and something might go wrong with the program. So there was a number of provisions, I just want to cite them quickly, that say we want to be able to get out. One of them I've already mentioned, that if the triggers are not hit, state starts getting hit for too much money, 120 days, it's over. Another trigger, you actually go in and require a person enrolling in the private option to affirmatively acknowledge that this program can be terminated upon appropriate notice. Of course, what's appropriate notice? Well, that might talk about the quality of the notice, the length of the notice, but we already know that 120 days under the Arkansas law was going to be good enough if the triggers were missed. So, again, there is a position there that we can get out of this fairly rapidly, built into the legislation. And then DHS's authority about their Medicaid state plan amendments, they are only allowed to do those that are optional and therefore may be revoked at its discretion. So, again, we're looking at this. We want to be able to get out. And then also the legislation at the end has a sunset bill, a sunset provision telling the date that the law will expire, and also mentions, it didn't have to be mentioned, but it's mentioned that it can be amended or extended. And, of course, an amendment could be to keep it in effect for another 10 years. It might be an amendment be that we're going to terminate it immediately. So those things, those concepts is continually all throughout this legislation about being able to get out of this. Now, in the CMS document, the special terms and conditions, they have it a little differently. They begin with requiring you a 7-month notice period. First, you have to notify the public for a month. Then you have to give 6 months of notice to CMS. Then that you have to submit a plan, a termination plan, phase-out plan, and it's up to CMS to decide, do we approve it or not? Now, there's no conditions listed there of can they just sit on this or not, but you've gone from a position of saying, we're going to give notice and we're going to get out of this if things go bad, to we're going to give notice and then we're going to sit around for approval. In addition, it says that you can't even begin to start get prepared for getting out of the private option until 14 days after we approve. So you can't prepare until 14 days after they approve. And then they added in a number of other provisions where you're going to have to set up procedures for people to appeal and possibly get into the regular Medicaid. And if someone has appealed their status, you're going to try to stop the program, and you're going to appeal that status, and the thing ends, private option ends in the middle of that appeal, you still have to cover them until the end of their appeal under the private option. So that whole concept of flexibility was not acknowledged in the terms and conditions that were accepted by state officials. Now, another part that was, put into the bill that would seem to be pretty important, it was repeated more than once, is this is not an entitlement. The person who's on it, in fact, somewhere there must be a document for each individual affirmatively stating, I affirmatively acknowledge that this thing can be terminated at notice, and that this is not an entitlement program. Because those affirmative knowledge, acknowledgement is required as part of being into the program. So twice they've told them it's not an entitlement program. Well, what is an entitlement program? I don't even want to try to debate that. You can look at it at a common definition. There's maybe something restrictive, which normally you go more of the common definition if you're looking at legislation that doesn't define it. But you're talking about giving some kind of rights to people. Well, it looked like everything was fine, and then you got to the terms and conditions. The terms and conditions says, as a condition for this program, when you start trying to terminate, you have to give these people an opportunity for hearing to get into Medicaid. And as I mentioned, you have to allow them to stay on the program while they're appealing. So we're giving legal rights to someone, and are we at that point where it's an entitlement because now they've got legal rights under the Medicaid program? You know, and it looks like the drafters intended this to be distinguished from the Medicaid program, and that's why they said no entitlement. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing that they've built into it with those procedures, I just point out that it doesn't look like it follows your law. And then another one's not a direct conflict, but I want to mention that they also impose a budget neutrality cap, which it's a common provision where the state's experience is more than what the federal government thinks it should be, that the state is subject to some of those things. But I would point out that there's not any exception in there for if that added to any other obligations of the state exceeded the triggers, the financial triggers. You know, it's possible that that neutrality position could put us into that position of it not complying anymore because of that additional benefit. I don't think those things were really considered. And, you know, I don't really know how the phase-out is set in the program is set in the waiver or whether it's even addressed. But when you get down to the end of the program, and if you're going to go down to the end of, June or July of 2017, whenever the date is, when you get there, it looks like you're still subject to all those seven-month periods, all that plan approval, all the procedures, and addition. So I just point those out as provisions that don't appear to match your legislation. And again, I can't tell you whether it was good or bad for those positions to be added. But the other consequence is it looks like that if we were just to say we're not going to follow these new rules that you've applied to us, this length of period, we may be subject to some penalties from the federal government for being in breach of the contract, which it looks like conflicts with the Act. So that's my statements with it. And again, I have all the statutes there that you can look at. I want to note that in the back there's some statutes listed. Those are not the codified sections, so the numbering's a little different. But the sections are there, and you know, you don't have to take my word for it. Take your look at it, and this is something that needs to be looked at because you know I think in Arkansas we tend to really value our legislation. And if the legislation's not what we still want it to be, then that's another situation where maybe that's something that needs to be amended to meet the federal. But your legislation and those federal provisions don't really see eye to eye.
All right. Just for clarification, Mr. Ferguson, you are an attorney, and you were head of the Bureau of Legislative Research right here in this very building for how many years?
I was the director for about 6 years and wrote legislation and analyzed legislation for about 32 years.
Right. So really, am I understanding this correctly, that you're saying that the triggers don't work? They may work, but then there will be such penalty. There will be a lot of penalties. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the triggers, by Arkansas law, they work. But that doesn't mean that we haven't made a bargain with the CMS that would require us to have some more responsibilities or maybe not let us follow the Arkansas law. So there's just a conflict between the two and could subject us to penalties for following the Arkansas law.
So could one penalty be that if we did not continue, that they could take away all the money that they give the state? I mean, would that, I've forgotten, it's called FFP, I think, financial.
I think that including some type of cost recovery in there would be one part. What remedies they would want to do, what federal programs they would want to reach out to. You know, I'm not going to say that these things are necessarily going to happen. Maybe you're going to be, some people seem to be happy with the program, and maybe you never get to the point where termination is an issue. Fine. But there are some triggers that it just can happen. If the federal government changes their reimbursement of the state, it's a trigger that you've set out. It has to happen within 120 days. And the federal term is saying there's no way that you can even comply with the first one of our requirements during that period of time.
I see. So it's kind of the carrot and the stick, huh? So they gave us the carrot, and now we're getting the stick. So, all right, there are several that would like to ask you questions. Mr. Ferguson, Representative Farrar, you're first. Go ahead.
Thank you. So in your opinion, and you've been doing this a long time, in your expert opinion, if we write a bill and we pass a law, and another document says that what we put in the law is not in the document that was approved, what usually happens to that law?
Well,
is it null and void, or do we have to redo, or what do we go by? Which one supersedes?
Well, I think we're in sort of a quandary because to some extent I would think that the terms and conditions to and in many provisions might be outside the scope of the law and invalid. But I do not know what happens once you make an agreement with the federal government, receive money from them, and then to say, whoops, we can't do this. And
how do we find that out?
I think there's to be some more research be done on what types of penalties they can pose and what happens if their requirements that we've agreed to have not complied with the state law.
Okay. I want to ask your opinion. What is your opinion?
I think that we're not bound by these terms and conditions because it was not within the scope of the act. And I don't think it was within the scope of any official to ignore the state provisions. Those provisions were not put in there just for filling space. They were there because there was a distinguishment needed to be made between Medicaid and this program, and there was a concern about being stuck into the program. So, you know, of course, I wasn't here during the last session, but just sitting up in Sharp County reading the paper, it looked to me like there was really some safeguards being put in there.
Okay.
And, you know, it's unfortunate that they don't necessarily meet with the federal government's idea, but that's something that people should have been watching for.
Well, so I guess the question, if we defund the private option, would we be bound by these regulations on the terms and conditions?
It's just Matthew may be able to address that in his. I haven't gone into those parts. I've primarily looked at, is there a conflict? Mm-hmm. How you resolve issues with the federal government, that's not something I've dealt in.
Okay. And the other statement, you said that the definition of entitlement, and I'm gonna read it to you. Entitlement is a government program providing benefits to members of a specific group. So this is an entitlement.
Well, and there are some definitions I've seen that talk about giving a legal right. And this is giving legal rights, and that's what really caught my attention, because I'm not really sure how you set this up not to be an entitlement program, but I know that the object was to avoid that happening. I just think we've gone down the road to it looking a whole lot more like an entitlement program.
By definition, I just read you, it's an entitlement.
By that definition, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Ballinger, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question actually was answered. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Representative Hammer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ferguson, the way you interpret things and with all your research and everything, when we submitted the waiver and people went up and advocated on behalf of Arkansas for the waiver that we sent up, the law was written to provide us as a state certain triggers if the federal government didn't play by the rules that we wrote the law by, expecting the federal government to comply with us. Do you see in your research that CMS wrote certain things into those number of pages you referenced a while ago, that if we as a state don't do certain things, then CMS has authority to do certain things, and basically what we're heading toward is a showdown. If we don't fund the private option, we're in all likelihood may end up in court over it. Is that a fair perception or not?
I think that, you know, no matter how strongly I feel one side or the other, you're probably headed for a lawsuit. But I assume that DHS spent a lot of time trying to make sure that everything they wrote complied with the law. Then when CMS gave their approval, they stuck a little gift with it. And this gift is what really conflicts.
Okay, and when did that gift get installed? After we as lawmakers voted on the law or prior to it?
No, this gift of conditions, I think, was sometime September, October, something like that. It was, you know, here is your approval. You may start your program, and oh, by the way, comply with these things. And I think they were overlooked because there were so many things that were actual mechanisms about making the program run that need to be looked at, where it wasn't assessed that, gee, does this really comply with the law? Now, when I was with the legislative research, one of the things we did from the time I got here was look at rules and regulations to see if they matched with the Act. And that's really what I'm doing here, but extending it out to a federal provision. So it's just something that every agency does, is look to see if those things comply.
Okay, I guess my last question, not to beat it, but as we tried to leverage the federal government, CMS has leveraged us, and inevitably, regardless of what we do, we either continue on the course we're going, or if we buck up and say, no, we want to change directions, somebody's going to take somebody to court, whether we sue them or whether they sue us, which would be a pretty aggressive move on either party's part. I don't know if the federal government wants to be the first, you know, to take Arkansas first to court over this, but is that conceivably an option? That'd
sure.
be a worst-case scenario, I understand, but would sure. that be an option?
And here's it's sort of a worst-case scenario, because on the one hand, you're going to defend your law. You're not going to ignore it. I mean, a lot of the criticism we see in the federal government is, you've written a law, now you've changed it. Well, that's not something I see in Arkansas. We've written a law, and we try to live within it or fix it. And in this case, the federal government has given us a brand new set of marching orders.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hammer. Senator Irvin, you're next.
Thank you, and you may have already said this, and because it's late. So, would state law trump this, or does this trump state law? The terms and conditions that were part of the condition of the waiver that was applied for and accepted.
I think the state law trumps, because everything is based on the state law. But I will not rule out the possibility we might not suffer some penalties from something that we shouldn't have agreed to.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right. Next is Representative Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ferguson, when you were with the Bureau and we would bring you legislation and, you know, we had a grandiose idea that we were going to do something, and y'all would come back to us and say that's unconstitutional or constitutional, and or if it complied with statutes or other codes in the law, and then we'd have to, you know, either proceed with the bill or not proceed with the bill, you know, without your advice, but you just tell us the way it is. In this case, why do you think we continue to go on, even though to me this is a big trigger, going from 120 days to 7 months?
I don't think it's been really talked about in committees and things. And, you know, I had to find out about it from a web blog that happened to post it, the 30-page document. So it was just because I'm sort of a government wonk sitting up drinking my coffee in Ash Flat that I even looked at it. But when it came up, I was asked about the possibility of penalties. My first thought was, yeah. And then I thought, wait a minute. This doesn't really match what I think I'm seeing the intent of the legislation is. And if this is not the intent of the legislation, are there some of these terms meaningless?
I know you keep on saying you're at home, and I'm happy for you that you're in retirement, but we miss you. But did you watch testimony or anything when there was constant talk about if triggers weren't met, we weren't going to go forward? From leadership, were you aware that those comments were made?
No, I watched none of the proceedings. You know, last regular session was the first session since January of 1981 that I wasn't a part of, and so I really wanted to keep myself from being that involved in it, and I had other matters to attend to. It's just that these things, I can't help but noticing some of them, and...
Good for you for staying away, but thank you very much.
All right. Representative Ballinger, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you hit on this, but I didn't necessarily see if it didn't get a clear answer. The issue of a lawsuit, there is that possibility that if we move forward and we defund it, that we'd be faced with a lawsuit. But if we don't move forward and defund it, are we also subject to the possibility of a lawsuit because of the conflict in the law?
Maybe not. Well, most of these provisions deal with what happens if you actually do try to exercise what the Act says. So until you decide to try to terminate at some point, these issues of the notice and that doesn't come up until it's actually tried.
And I guess really my question is not so much the issue of somebody who feels like this is an entitlement because of the rights granted under the waiver, but a citizen who felt like that the law was violated and so therefore should get an injunction against it being enforced. Are we not subject to that because, you know, here we are, we're in somewhat gray territory where we have a bill that grants some authority and then that scope was exceeded.
Okay, I understand. Now, I thought you were just dealing with the termination part, sure. But the benefits part, it's certainly a possibility that some court may have to decide, is this an entitlement and does it violate the law because the law says it can't be an entitlement?
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that very much.
All right, thank you. Representative Rice, you're next. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and since I'm not a committee member, I appreciate being recognized. Mr. Ferguson, I have been here since 2009, and being around you, I greatly respect you. I respect your opinion. I'm sad that, I know there was other things scheduled today, but I'm sad we couldn't have a two-way conversation from kind of two different sides. I think it's very important. This room ought to be full to hear this. In your opinion, who do you think is responsible for accepting provisions contrary to what the Arkansas law says?
Of course, those came back to DHS and the governor. And again, I think that they just were not examined sufficiently to realize there's a possible conflict.
Well,
I have to say that having worked for the legislature for 32 years, I haven't got it out of my blood to be very protective of state laws. Whether I like them or not, I've always been frustrated when I see the state laws changed by an agency or the courts. And so that's why these type of issues come up to me. And I think it's something that's important to y'all. And, again, some of these things probably were just overlooked.
And I can appreciate that. We find things, I know, from time to time, you know, who sets ballot titles and just numerous things that happen in the law and we don't get right. This is a huge thing. And the ramifications, whether it goes one way or another, is great. There's a lot of people affected by this, and we ought to have been having some debate on both sides. I'm just very concerned that we didn't have the opportunity to know all of the things that we had asked. The legislature, many had asked to wait. Let's see how this thing unfolded. We have had misinformation from Washington. For whatever reason, if it's what it appears to be on the surface, to me is very serious. And I hope we can have some further input in this, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Chairman Burris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ferguson, thank you. Had you sent this to DHS?
No. This is the first time that it's come out. It's been developing. In fact, I'm sitting there in a hotel room finishing up this morning.
I appreciate the work. I think it's worth discussion. There's also a process, and they're good questions. We're at the point where their discussion can continue. I don't think anybody was implying that this is the only discussion that will take place. This is the first time I'd seen any of it. And I think DHS just got the documents as it was presented to us. So we can get good answers, and they're good questions.
And again, I keep saying this is one of those things that sort of, I think, just slipped through, and it really needs to be examined whether or not you might come up with a way to say maybe these aren't violations, or you say they are violations. It needs to be looked at, but I think everybody was pretty happy when the waiver, or the people that were receiving the waiver were happy, and this document was just a bunch more paper that was stuck with it. And if it wasn't for the question of someone asking me about penalties, that I would not have realized that this document was really out there and has so much potential to conflict with the law.
Thank you.
All right. Next is Representative Douglas.